Good morning, 743, 65 degrees, and it is time for our chat with the folks from K-State Research and Extension's Wildcat District. Joining us, we have Wendy Powell and Jesse Gilmore. Good morning. How are y'all doing?
Good morning. Great.
Doing
how are you?
Pretty good.
Good deal. We've got some events coming up, so let's get into those first before we get in.
Yeah, we're going to do our Kubota Hay Day on the 23rd. It's a Friday coming up. That's going to be from 11 to 4. So this is an opportunity for folks to test drive Kubota hay equipment. I'm going to be out there talking about hay field and pasture management during drought conditions, and then also the equipment available from the Montgomery County Conservation District will be out there for folks to look at and discuss with the district manager about using those on your property. So that event is going to take place about 6 miles west of the Highway 75 junction with 160. So about 7 miles west of Roman's Outdoor Power there in Independence. For more information, look that up on Facebook or on our website. It's going to be a pretty fun, well, interesting day. Lots of opportunity to look at equipment and learn about some pasture and hayfield management.
Excellent. Very
lunch
good.
Lunch provided.
Ooh. Well, we always like that.
Yes. And no need to RSVP.
We would like that too.
Yes.
That's great. Okay. Well, good deal on that. Appreciate it, Wendy. And Jesse, going to talk a little bit as, the drought unfortunately persists despite recent rains. So drought injury in trees.
Yeah. So the K-State Garden Hour is today. It is the first Wednesday of the month, and they are actually talking about drought-tolerant plant choices for Kansas landscapes. With how dry we've been, that's always important. Obviously, plants are going to need different amounts of water over the growing season. But we're seeing, I've been getting a lot of calls, and they are pretty much all about trees. And usually when people are calling, it's because at least part of the canopy looks like it's dying off. And this is happening a lot in trees you wouldn't really expect to see drought injury in. Things like oaks, maples, silver maples in particular seem to be hit pretty hard. This is paradoxically, because they have grown used to a certain amount of water in the spring every year, and especially last year, from June pretty much up to now, we have been in a persistent drought. Drought isn't just determined by how much rainfall we've had recently. It's the deviation from the norm. Kansas, K-State, has a set of weather stations set up across the state. It's, I think, somewhere around 40, that track precipitation and agriculture-related climate info, like growing degree days. It's called the Kansas Mesonet. And there are three, I think, stations in our immediate area. There's Sedan, there's Parsons, and there's Columbus. Last time I checked, Sedan was 23 inches below average rainfall for the last 365 days. And so when you have such an extreme deviation from the norm, that's going to really hit plants hard. And it's going to hit plants that have grown used to that kind of climate, weirdly, harder than newer plants. You can work around a little bit of drought with newer plants with your watering practices, but we're going to talk a little bit first about what you can expect to see in drought injury. So in trees, your drought injury is really going to start showing at the tops and the tips of branches, because those are the farthest points away from the water source, which is where the roots are in the soil. So as water travels up the tree, the lower branches and the trunk take what they need first, and whatever's left over keeps moving farther up. It's kind of like a packed elevator. People start leaving on the lower floors, and the people that have to go to the higher floors, it takes longer for them to get up there. In periods of extreme drought, when you're not watering because you think that a landscape tree can manage, especially because it's been reportedly drought tolerant, like known as a drought tolerant species like silver maple, then you don't water. It has a very limited pool of water to basically distribute throughout as much of the plant as it can. And a lot of times the top of the tree is left with little to no water to keep the wood alive.
Well, and I think people, including myself, would think, oh, it's a tree. You don't have to water it. It just gets, it just does its own thing.
Yeah, no, it is very, very important. Obviously, with plant selection, you can mitigate a lot of water needs, but it is still important to make sure that you are watering during the lean times when you're not getting rain.
Is there anything special we should do as far as watering trees? You know, maybe like a more of a trickle for a longer period of time. What's the kind of the best practice on that?
No, dunk the root system with a bunch of water about once every 5 to 7 days, depending on what species you've got. The deeper in the soil profile you can encourage that water to go, the less you're going to have evaporate off the top. Or the more water you're going to effectively get to your tree, because it's going down deeper where the sunlight can't evaporate it into the atmosphere. And B, especially in newer trees, you're going to develop that root system really deep because it root systems will follow water down.
Okay.
If it's like I assign a lot of like human thoughts to plants. They're not sentient, obviously, but the way they think of it is, why would I grow my roots deeper if everything I need is right here on the surface? Mm. So shallow watering, shallow, more frequent watering in particular, is going to create a very shallow root system. That's also why we don't fertilize newer trees, is we want to encourage them to go down for their nutrients.
Well, and even especially when we have high winds, we want those roots to go down. We want that tree to have a better anchor.
Yep.
So it doesn't just come over on the house or something.
Oh yeah, there's a lot of benefits to growing a deep root system. Most trees are going to have a taproot. Oaks are the exception. They grow their roots out instead of down. So shallow watering is at least more effective on oaks than it would be on other trees. That is also probably why we are seeing quite a bit of oak dieback. Oaks are the one group of trees I'm getting questions about more than any other right now. And that's because of the delayed drought stress. You're not always going to see drought stress in the season that it's occurring. I have had quite a few people tell me about their trees and how, oh, they looked fine last year, they dropped their leaves, and then this year they just didn't come back. Even in winter plants, some plants are going to need watering, and that's kind of tricky because you don't really think about watering in the winter, but evergreen plants like hollies, pines, some magnolias, depending on what species of magnolia you've got. I imagine most of our magnolias in the area aren't going to be evergreen, but there are, you know, the rare exceptions that are grown in the perfect spot that stays warmer during the winter. They are going to lose a lot of water from the winds that are super dry and reduce the humidity around the plant. Humidity, just like with people, prevents water from evaporating off of plants and out of plants. Leaves have stomata or pores that open up to bring carbon dioxide in for photosynthesis, but when they're open, that water can evaporate out. And the sunlight, even in winter, does a lot of work for evaporating water out of leaves if it's getting hit by direct sunlight. So you need to make sure that you are watering during the winter because of those drier winds, as well as during the summer when you're not getting a ton of rain. Because our winter last year was very, very dry compared to usual. We did not get very many snow occurrences, and we did not get very many freezing rain occurrences. I think freezing rain actually happened more than snow.
Yeah, I only remember one big snow, so
I don't remember it getting very cold either. So in those warmer winters, you might also get some deciduous plants that don't fully go into dormancy, and they would need water too. So, yeah, watering pretty tricky, but it's also pretty important for keeping plants as healthy as possible.
Now, what about some of our, you know, production trees like pecans? I mean, we've got lots in the Chautauqua area, that sort of thing. How do they do with the drought?
They don't. I can, and that's actually one of the most interesting questions I have gotten on the job, is I was approached by an insurance adjuster to determine the drought's impact on the yield of pecans. And that is an impossible question to answer, but I found some back of the napkin math, and I cannot remember exactly what the amount of water each tree needed was, but it was something ludicrous. Wow. Like, you would go broke trying to irrigate that unless you had access to, like, a river or a pond. Trying to irrigate that on rural or city water is just not going to happen. So, in a lot of cases, pecans, they're hickories. So, they're native to northern Mexico, southwestern United States, typically. Do very well in Texas, where they don't get as much rain as we get here. But again, the plants are adapted to a specific level of rain, and when they don't get that rain, they get mad. They get mad and they get sick. So even if they are native to drier areas, it's what's known as provenance or provenance. I don't know how to pronounce it. It looks like a French word, so I'm pretty sure it's number two. But gathering seed from a specific area from plants that are adapted to a specific climate will make those subsequent plants more likely to succeed. You want to practice good local provenance if you can, if you're gathering seeds from the wild. But it is also probably prudent to start selecting varieties of plants that are adapted to drier environments, because I don't want to say that this is going to be the new norm, but it feels in my gut like it is. And there are plants that you can select that have varieties that are more drought tolerant. We just need to kind of shift towards a more water scarce mentality with the plants that we select for our landscape. And if we do have the ability to water, if we have, you know, the funds to chip in 10 or 20 extra dollars in the water bill each month, it's usually worth doing that to keep your plants alive, because the value of a mature landscape tree, people don't really realize how much they do for A, the aesthetics, B, the lower utility bills if you're getting shaded out by large oak or maple trees, and see the value to wildlife and the ecosystem.
Yeah, and
as
I mean,
well,
I would even think that would factor into some property value. I mean, you think about a neighborhood that is just, you know, maybe brand new construction where it's just barren landscape versus a nice kind of mature neighborhood with lots of trees, lots of shade. I mean, just from a curb appeal to me, I mean, that's just from my perspective, the mature trees are definitely just add so much.
Yeah, if you're in a lot of cases, if you've got a new construction in a managed neighborhood, like homeowners association type, most homeowners associations are actually going to put in the charter that you're going to be required to have trees, at least on the street. So homeowners associations have caught on to the value of trees in the landscape, and they do a lot for just the general appeal of your landscape overall. So it is always beneficial to keep trees alive for as long as possible, and they probably will take a little bit of babying. If you do run into parts of a tree that you think are dead, the flex test is always a good way to determine if they've been cut off from water. You just flex the tips of the branches that are showing the problems, and if it bends with your flexing, that means the part of the tree is still getting water and it's just a leaf problem at that point. There's a lot of different things that could cause trees to drop their leaves. Could be disease, could be insect pressure, but usually as long as it's a one-off occurrence and is not happening year after year after year, you are going to usually see a tree pull through that kind of thing. But if it snaps, if it's brittle, then it's been cut off from water, and at that point it would need to be removed.
We got 1 minute left, Jesse. I have a question from a listener about stump removal. What are the best practices for stump removal?
Ooh, I have not done a ton of stump removal. Actually, I have not done any stump removal. I worked for a landscaping company, and that was not really anything we ever had to do. We did a lot of pruning. Usually, you're going to grind it down to the soil, and the roots will just decay from there. If you've got a walnut tree that you're trying to remove the stump of, that's going to be a little different, because walnut trees exude a chemical called juglone, which will kill about half of all of the landscape plants that will grow in our area. So those roots, even if they are dying and decaying, will still release that chemical. So you still need to know what species of tree you're getting rid of. And in 99% of cases, the roots and the stump are not going to be a problem. You'd just have them ground down when you get the tree removed.
Real quick, what's your number if people need to get a hold of you, Jesse, in your office?
Sure. 620-724-8233 is the Girard office number.
Okay. All right. Well, thank you, Jesse. Coming up, we have Wendy Pell talking about some factors affecting chemical weed control. That's on the way here on KGGF. Good morning, 810 here on the Mighty 690 as we continue throughout a Wednesday. And joining us now, we have, again, the folks from K-State Research and Extension's Wildcat District. We have Jesse Gilmore and Wendy Powell here to talk a little bit about factors affecting chemical weed control. So
yes,
we like our chemical weed control, but hey, sometimes there's some problems with it.
There can be. Yeah, I had a call yesterday. A guy had a certain type of algae in his pond, and he'd been putting this one chemical on it and was not seeing any results. Well, after we talked a little bit more about what kind of algae he had, he was using the wrong chemical.
Ah.
So even our books would say that chemical is not effective on that type of algae. So this is certainly something that we want to keep an eye on, using the correct product for the type of problem that you have. So that's when our ID, our identification of plants, comes in.
Sure. So I mean, that's an important first step in, you know, figuring out where we're going to go, because you have to identify the right kind of plant. And I didn't even think of, you know, algae being, you know, a plant in the water.
Mm-hmm. Yep, exactly. And there's all kinds of herbicides out there. There's aquatic herbicides, like I said, for pond weeds. I deal mostly with pasture weeds, but there's all kinds of herbicides for trees and crops and just everything. And sometimes herbicide is not the answer. So some of these factors affecting chemical weed control, we can transfer this to maybe some mechanical or cultural weed control. Cultural weed control being like stocking rates or timed grazing with certain seasons. And mechanical weed control is kind of like using a bulldozer to take out some red cedars or something like that. So there's lots of different ways to control weeds. It doesn't always have to be chemical. But if you are going to spend the money on herbicide, you certainly want to do it correctly, because it is not cheap and it's pretty labor intensive to get it out there.
Wendy, I learned last week that the hardness of the water that you mix in with the chemical can impact its effectiveness at killing plants. I think specifically the one I was taught about was glyphosate or Roundup, and the harder your water is, water hardness is just a level of the minerals in the water, the less effective your chemical is going to be. Is that true for other chemicals as well?
Yes, that's exactly right. That's certainly on our list of factors. So anytime that you use an herbicide and you're mixing it with water, which is our most common carrier, is water. Sometimes folks will use liquid fertilizers, but commonly it's water. You certainly want to make for sure that you're using clean water. You don't want to use something out of the pond that's been filtered. You want to maybe spend a little few more pennies getting good water to mix in with your herbicide to make for sure that's going to be effective. That's also going to play into the solubility of the herbicide. If you're using a liquid herbicide mixed with water versus a granular product, something like that. So there are so many different factors. The list here, I don't know, there's like 15 or so. The rate of application, the uniformity and depth of the incorporation. You know, how big is the plant to get the herbicide down to the soil? Does the herbicide need to go on the plant leaf or onto the soil near the root system? So these are all like big questions to ask. And you can learn all of this by reading the label. And anytime you get a chemical recommendation from Extension or anywhere, you certainly want to read the label to know the rate, first of all, and then look at the size of your plant, make for sure the rate matches the size of the plant. For example, ragweed. Right now, ragweed is quite a bit taller than it was a month ago, so you would need to use a heavier rate.
That rain just shot it straight up. It was pretty evident how much the rain factored into the ragweed growth here in the last 2 weeks or so.
Yes. Yeah, there's been a lot of growth on a lot of different weeds. And making for sure that we have the correct ID on those weeds is really, really important. There's some apps out there. I was talking to a lady yesterday who found an app that she liked with where you snap a picture of it and the app tells you what kind of plant it is. Certainly use the tools that are available to you folks, but make for sure that it's correct. You know, check the leaf arrangement. Is it are the leaves opposite each other on the stem or are they alternate? Because those little details like that can help you with your identification for one, but also if you're using the wrong herbicide, you're just wasting your money and nobody needs to do that right now.
Oh, sure.
Yeah, there one thing I found recently regarding apps, not necessarily an app, but I have an iPhone, and when you take pictures on your iPhone, if you go into the photos menu for your iPhone, there are some photos that you can take where it will basically compare against other photos that Apple has in a database to make sure that or to give you the info about what kind of plant it is. And I've actually found that to be pretty accurate. It's definitely obviously worth double checking to confirm, but I've actually had more success with that than any third-party app in the App Store. So yeah. That would be worth looking into, too, if you have an iPhone.
Yeah, I think there's a Google
tool. The Lens.
On my phone. So, yeah, certainly feel free to use those tools, but be skeptical and do your research. Don't just take the first picture that comes up for a yellow flower because there are a lot of yellow flowers.
Now, what about rainfall? How does this factor in into our application maybe of some of this herbicide?
Yeah, that's a great question. So sometimes if we get rain like 12 hours or so after an herbicide has been applied, we're golden. That rain has no effect whatsoever on the herbicide because the plant has already taken it in. However, you have to read the label because there's some herbicides that need to set on the plant for like 2 days before a rainfall. And sometimes the amount of rainfall matters. So any amount, like even a heavy morning dew, can wash an herbicide off of a plant leaf. It really all is such a huge dependent on the type of herbicide. There's no one answer fits all here. And that's what makes things so difficult.
So for a lot of herbicides that are contact herbicides, it's the evaporation that actually deposits the chemical into the plant, right? The evaporation of the water leaving the chemical behind?
Yes. There's a lot of that. So think of like salt water, and as salt water evaporates, you have a residue of salt.
You have the crust.
Yeah, and that's what affects the plant to do some control work there.
So on hotter days, would you see more effectiveness of the herbicide in question typically?
It all depends on the salt content of the herbicide. So a lot of our auxin herbicides, dicamba, 2,4-D, things like that, you can have that, the heat of the day will affect the volatility of the herbicide. And some plants or some herbicides are different, where they go into the soil and they need to get contact with the base of the stem and down to the roots. So all of these are different modes of action for herbicides. And there's a ton of different modes of action we can talk about. Just like with insecticides or fertilizers, different things are affected in different ways with the heat of the day, with rainfall, with other climate factors. So read the label. I know those labels can really put you to sleep sometimes, but if you're able to find them online, and there's a couple of websites out there that have the current herbicide label, you can just do a control F, search for the plant that you're trying to control, and it'll actually search through the label for you, where you don't have to read the whole entire thing.
Now, for folks who are perhaps interested in, you know, obtaining some of these herbicides, is there anything that you have to do specifically to get them? I mean, are these pretty much available, don't say over the counter, but, you know, from your feed store, sure, that sort of thing? Do you have to have any special parameters to get any of these?
Yeah, that's a great question. So there's a lot of herbicides that are available over the counter, as you say, at the farm store, just wherever. One of the most commonly used is glyphosate, which is Roundup in many different formulations. And there are others that are, I'm going to call them like heavier duty herbicides, like Duracor, Grazon. Some of these, they're more serious. You really need to pay very close attention to your personal protective equipment whenever you're applying. And these are called what we use restricted use herbicides. And a lot of times you'll have to have a custom applicator certification, which is kind of like a license, or go through some extra education to get that certification.
Yeah, typically in my experience, when it comes to restricted use pesticides, there's two reasons why a pesticide would be restricted use and you would need a license in order to apply it. The first, very, very high chance of negative health impacts if you're not applying it properly, if you're over applying it, or if you are accidentally exposed to the pesticide. Paraquat is the one that we were always taught about at K-State that scared the crap out of me, hearing about some of the stories of people were exposed to paraquat. The other reason why a pesticide might be restricted use is because of negative environmental impacts if the pesticide were to escape. A lot of times when I'm dealing with pesticides, it is typically going to be negative impact to either pollinators or fish. I see a lot of warnings on labels about killing off potential fish populations if it were to run off into a pond that has been stocked.
Oh, sure. Yeah. So, no, that can be. And then we get into the late summer and algae blooms and all that sort of thing. Now, we see, you know, crop dusters around. Are they actually spraying herbicide, pesticide, fertilizer? What actually is that? I know that's more of a crop question, but less pasture.
It really depends. There's a lot of different things that those crop dusters can be applying. And really, it's hard to say. Most of the time, they're applying a powder, and that could be a fertilizer, it could be an herbicide, it could be an insecticide. We had a lot of problems in the wheat crop this year with a fungus, so it could be a fungicide. Those crop dusters are really versatile in making for sure that we are able to raise a healthy crop.
Sure. Well, and then back to the livestock production aspect of this, what do we need to know about, you know, if we're going to be applying a herbicide to our pasture? What do we need to be thinking about when we're talking about harvest and slaughter and grazing?
Yeah, that's a great question. So all herbicides will list on there their grazing restrictions. And most of the time, they'll list meat animals and lactating animals. So think of like dairy goats or dairy cows that you're using for milk production or cheese or whatever byproduct of that milk. And then the meat product is actually the withdrawal time for slaughter. So before removal of the animal for slaughter, a lot of times it's going to be a few days up to a month. You just have to read the label. And this is going to be applied, that's, we're talking pastures here. Whenever we're talking hay fields, that's a whole different set of numbers, because those plants are actually going to be mowed down, and so that herbicide sits in the plants, in the stem or in the leaf or in the flower or whatever it is, and then it gets baled up. And so that is a whole nother set of restrictions. So if you're applying herbicide to a hay field, you certainly have to look at the hay harvest intervals rather than the grazing intervals. So there's lots of different restrictions, even with aquatic herbicides. Yesterday I was talking to the same fella about his algae, and he was considering getting sheep. Well, whenever we start talking about algae control in a pond, a lot of times copper comes into the conversation, copper sulfate. So if you throw sheep into the mix, they're not going to be doing very well. So that's it's a whole nother, it's not even a grazing restriction, maybe a water access restriction. I'm not sure what you call that, but it's certainly something to be mindful of, because sheep are very sensitive to copper. Mm,
interesting.
Wendy, in a lot of crop cases, we've got two restrictions. We've got the pre-harvest interval, which is the amount of time between when you apply the pesticide and when you can harvest the produce for consumption. And then you've got the restricted entry interval, or I believe it's REI, where that's the amount of time before workers can go back into the field where they have applied the pesticide. Would the REI apply for pastures as well? In your experience, does REI play into the herbicides you use in pastures?
Yeah, so that's going to be something that's listed in the label, and something that we'd need to keep in mind would be our personal protective equipment, our PPE, when we're applying it. But most of the time, when we're talking in pasture or hayfield situations, folks aren't going into those daily. I mean, you go out there and you do what you need to do, and then it's on to the next chore for the day or for the week. So I don't know a whole lot about restricted entry intervals for pasture and hayfield herbicides, but certainly if there's going to be any concern, it's going to be on the label. So that's another great question to get an answer from the label.
Now, what about wind speed? It's a really calm day today. Would it be better to apply this on a calm day, or do you actually want a little bit of wind to maybe carry it through the pasture?
Sure, that's a great question. Kind of like with prescribed fire, we do need a little bit of help from the environment. So you want just a certain amount of wind. There's going to be what we call drift. We want to control that drift. The drift is when, like, the droplet comes out of the sprayer and moves away from the sprayer. How far it goes will depend on how big the droplet is, how high the wind speed is, and the direction, things like that. So your nozzle size on the sprayer, the distance of the sprayer height from the ground, all of these factors are going to play a huge role in how well the herbicide actually gets to the plant the way it needs to.
The spray pattern of the nozzle as well.
Yes, whether it's a fan or a circle, or it's a whole science. And calibrating sprayers, that's something I didn't mention earlier, but that's certainly important. Calibrating your sprayer, there's a whole huge worksheets on how to do this. And it can be a lot of math, but really it all comes down to how fast you're going across your hayfield or pasture, making for sure that the spray that's coming out, the herbicide that's coming out, is going to be applied to each plant at the proper rate. So, for instance, if you're driving too slowly and your droplet size is really large, then that means you're going to run out of spray really early, and you're not going to be able to get across the whole field. However, if you're driving too fast and your droplet sizes are large, then that means you're going to hit every few plants nicely, but several will be skipped. So that speed going across the field is going to play a huge factor in that calibration.
So does residue stay in the tanks from previous applications, and how thoroughly would you need to clean out the tanks before going on to the next chemical? Because I've seen some instances where people have sprayed things that should not kill, like they've sprayed either a grass-selective herbicide that is supposed to kill grasses but not touch broadleaves, or the other way around, that's supposed to kill broadleaves but not touch grasses, but they had something from a previous spray still in the tank in enough quantities where it caused injury to the thing they wanted to protect.
Yeah, that's an excellent point. We certainly want to be cleaning our sprayers out with a triple rinse. So I was seeing some demonstrations back a few years ago where they were using the different rinse water. The first rinse on some soybeans had the exact same kill effect as the herbicide application.
Oh my.
And then the second rinse was a little bit lighter damage. And then the third rinse was even lighter than that. So you certainly want to be rinsing things out at least three times. Make for sure that you, on the containers that the herbicide actually comes in, those are usually not reusable. So go ahead and get those rinsed out so that you get your money's worth of product, and then puncture those containers or crush them and dispose of them properly. If you don't know how to dispose of your chemical containers, give us a call and we can help you figure that out. It's really kind of frowned upon just to make a pile of them behind the barn, but I know that does
that
happen.
That doesn't happen. I've never seen that.
So just something
you're talking about.
Yeah, keep that in mind to keep your place cleaned up a little bit.
Now, do herbicides have an expiration that we need to be aware of?
Absolutely, yes. Definitely read the label on the bottle and be checking the bottle or container for that information. And before, I don't know how much time we have left, but I certainly want to take some time to mention poison hemlock.
Yeah, absolutely.
I
hate that plant.
Yeah. So we have got poison hemlock in spades this year. For those of you not familiar with the plant, it's biannual, which means that it takes 2 years to go through its full cycle. And so with the crazy weather patterns that we've had the last 2 years, I just see it everywhere in places that I've never seen hemlock before either. And you can identify hemlock driving down the road because it gets clumpy. It's white right now. The flower is white. A lot of times you'll see it in like culverts or in ditches that
likes a little more moist of an environment.
Yeah. And then the other plant that looks very similar to it, it's going to be wild carrot, which is also a white flower. But those wild carrot plants will be solitary. They don't clump. So it's kind of spread out single plants where hemlock bunches up and it's also more branched.
I would like to give some additional identification options because poison hemlock is the most poisonous plant in the Western Hemisphere. I am sure that causes problems for livestock if they ever graze on it, so you definitely want to control it. But you do not want to be grabbing it barehanded. I made the mistake of doing that 2021 when I was identifying it in someone's back 40. I grabbed it, and then about 10 minutes later, my hand broke out in the most painful rash I have ever had. So you can actually topically dose yourself with the alkaloid that would kill you if you ingested it. There's no known instances of death from topical exposure, but you definitely want to avoid that if possible. So poison hemlock. There's three ways you can tell what poison hemlock is from wild carrot, aside from the clumping. Poison hemlock will have hollow stems, hairy stems, and purple blotched stems. It's all about the stems. Or did I say hairy? I meant hairless. Queen Anne's lace or wild carrot is the one with the hairy stems. So those are three ways you can tell if you're dealing with poison hemlock. And if you are, you definitely want to control it.
Yes. And you have about till mid-July when those plants start to mature, when the seeds become viable, to get that under control. The seeds will only be viable in the soil for 2 to 3 years, but as the plant matures is when the seed becomes viable. So you definitely want to be, if you've got that in your pasture, remove your animals. They will have problems. Even if they don't have a toxic amount ingested of that hemlock, they can still have some birth defects on anything that they're pregnant with.
Well, and even this goes for pretty much anyone, I would think. Even if you have a dog animal could eat it, let alone a kid. I mean, that would be terrible. I'd hope that wouldn't happen. But I mean, kids do all sorts of weird stuff when they're playing outside. So yeah, that's something that anyone and everyone should definitely be aware of.
Yes. So certainly keep an eye out for that. There are chemicals out there that you can spray on those plants to get some control on them. And anybody with questions can certainly give us a call at the extension office. I can be reached at the Altamont office. That number is 620-724-5337.
Okay. All righty. Well, lots of good information. Appreciate Wendy, Jesse coming on by and sharing it with us. And I look forward to chatting again here real soon.
Thank you.
Yep.
All right. And we'll be back with Open Line, an early bird edition coming up here on the Mighty 690.